I'm Peggy Clark, and welcome to The Bridge. The Bridge features wise women and a few good men of different generations in revelatory conversation about what matters most. The Bridge is a podcast of the Aspen Institute, a nonpartisan forum for values-based leadership and the exchange of ideas. Today, I'm greeting you from sunny Kigali, Rwanda, having just come from the north of Rwanda, not far from the borders of Uganda and the Democratic Republic of Congo. I'm here in part to attend the official opening of the University of Global Health Equity. It's a strategic place to put a new, bold kind of university. This university trains students in delivering healthcare services to those who need it most. The university was co-founded by our guest and my dear friend today, Dr. Agnes Binawahu, who serves as its vice chancellor. Dr. Agnes has had a distinguished career, more than 20-year career, leading healthcare in Rwanda, including as a pediatrician, as executive director of Rwanda's AIDS Commission, as permanent secretary of Ministry of Health, and then 5 years as the Ministry of Health, among many, many, many other accomplishments, including being a great grandmother. She's also a senior advisor to the Director General of the World Health Organization and a senior lecturer at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Agnes led Rwanda to achieve the greatest improvements in health we have seen anywhere in the world, and that is just the beginning of what Dr. Agnes will be doing with us today. So, Dr. Agnes, we're so glad to have you here with us today. You've spent your life fighting for rights, specifically for the right to health for so many. But let me turn it a little bit to you in a personal question. When did you, in your own life, first experience the fragility of rights, either your own or others around you, either civil rights or women's rights?
Thank you, Peggy. First of all, I want to tell the audience that Peggy is my dearest sister from another continent because we have the same goals, the same objective across the world, doing it differently in our capacities, but it's like we have drink the same breast milk, the milk of social justice and global rights. Access to care. So I want to say that the first time I record in my memory, and it's something that traumatized me so much that it's still a guiding moment of everything I was doing. I was 7 and I was in my first ever class in primary school. So that means for me, it was an achievement as a child. I'm going to what we call in French, la grande école. That means the time when a child enter in an official learning process to be part of a society. I was very proud. And the first book I received was a book about religion. And I was in a religion school, in a nun school, boarding school, and I love teaching, but I love more learning. So I was so excited, and I turned all the pages of the book from A to Z. I was coming from home, and I didn't know so much the external world. I know my mom, my dad, my brothers and sisters, friends of family, and the majority of them were black people. And even if we were in Leuven, a city in Belgium, where my father was pursuing medical education, the majority of the people surrounding me were black and good people. But in this book, there were no black. And the only black person was the devil, an ugly devil, telling to the people that they were condemned for eternity. So I was shocked and I raised my hands genuinely. I was the only black in the class, but that was not disturbing me because the shop where I was going to take the bread across my home was full of white people. The road was full of white, good people. So I raised my hand and said, you know, I'm surprised there is no black people in this book. There is only one black. He's an ugly devil. Where are the black people going? Because in my heart, my parents were so good that I don't see them going somewhere else than paradise. But I didn't know about racism, nothing. So I was punished for my question. I was sent in the corner of the class on my knee for a crime I didn't understand. But I understand something. I asked a question that made the people that I was, for me, they were God, you know. They have the power of everything they were told. I was a very small kid. And I make them afraid with a question. That means my question has value. Yeah. I ask a question, and I came in this school to learn and to be educated. And this was denied to me. I understand that. And in that corner, I decide that forever I will ask the hard question, and I don't care if the world put me in a corner. I'm ready to face it. And I, because the justice was, I'm entitled to be educated and to receive answer. I understand that there was a color issue, but I didn't get what, because I didn't know what racism was. And I understand that this nun that was an adult, and that was who was my hero, because she was there to open me to the world, was a fake person. And I decided to never respect anyone for the title or the role they have, but they have to deserve deserved my respect.
Wow. Dr. Agnes, that's incredible. I love that. I will always ask the hard question. Yeah. And knowing
and
that
I was seven.
And you were seven. And knowing, sitting in that corner, that your question had power because it made them uncomfortable. That's amazing. Seven. Wow. Okay, so let's jump to last week. I was so honored to be a part of the opening of the University of Global Health Equity with you and Paul Farmer and the president of Kigami and amazing young students just a few days ago. I need to tell the listeners that there was not a dry eye in the house. Everybody was very, very, very moved by your accomplishments. So congratulations. This is a culmination of a dream for you, and it must be a very exciting time. So can you tell us a little bit about why this university is so important to you and why it's an innovative contribution to global healthcare?
This university is a dream for me, but for many others. And important because me and many others, a couple of years ago and now, many others I experience it now as we talk, the difficulties to build systems. I came here, and I'm going to make the story short, as a good pediatrician, capable to give the care, the simple care as much as intensive care for children, but also for neonate, what is the most difficult thing. But I was not able to provide the care I am skilled with just because there were no systems. So after 1 week of working in Rwanda, I was saving baby during the day or during the night. And when I'm going home, I come back and the baby was dead. And I ask why. And the mistake done, even if I cannot be absolutely annoyed against the people who make the mistake, because I understand that they didn't know. They were not educated. They were not trained to provide such a care. And me, unfortunately, I would love to be a robot that doesn't need time to sleep and recover so that I can save my baby from A to Z. But during the time I was not there, my baby was dying. So education was top of my priority. And I decided to educate on site. We lost a baby. We do the verbal autopsy of this lost. What could be done better? Sometime for one baby, it was 1 week of education. And That's for the clinical part. But also, we didn't have the drugs, even if the money was there, because there were no good supply chain. So we had to create a system of supply chain. So this university is the solution for the young people. And university teaches us the skills to be good clinical service providers, but doesn't teach doctors to create the system they need for providing and exercising those clinical skills they have gained. So we decided to combine everything, stop doing that on site, produce doctors, nurses, and other clinicians that have the skills to create the system they need to provide the skills they have learned.
So it's important to say that that university is perhaps unique in the world, right, Dr. Agnes? There are
absolutely, because it's the only university based on implementation science, meaning, you know, my degree as a doctor, as a doctor, not as a pediatrician, it's another degree, but it says the heart of healing. It's so beautiful because I have the skills to heal, but I'm an artist and I love that. And now we are going to provide the clinician on top of the heart of healing, the heart of building system, the heart of the know-how. And this is based on implementation science, the heart of doing. So in the heart of this university, we have equity. What is rare, because we teach our students, those are the skills we give you, but whatever time we exercise it, focus on the most vulnerable. And on the other hand, we give them the skills in the heart of building the system they need, whatever place in the world, to exercise those skills. Fantastic. So this is unique.
Very unique. So it's incredible. We're really eager to support you in that, Dr. Agnes, particularly at Aspen. So we're really excited about that. But let's turn a little bit. I think some of our listeners may not know about your remarkable career in health leadership in Rwanda. And Rwanda is one of the few countries on a fast track in reducing child and maternal mortality. And on your watch as Minister of Health, the rates of death of women as well as children under five decreased by more than 70%. How did you accomplish this, and what can the rest of the world learn from these dramatic accomplishments?
So it is a dramatic accomplishment, but I'm so proud as a Rwandan to live in a country with dramatic improvement in all sectors. And I insist on that because a health sector in the vacuum is nothing. It's like a human floating in the space, in the vacuum between the moon and the earth. You will do nothing, just floating forever. We had success in my country in changing things and work together for human development, because health sector, education sector, employment sector, security sector, transport sector came together. And I don't name all of them. All of them, we came together and decided, what can we do to improve the human development trajectory of our people? And we did that. And you will never say it enough under the leadership of a visionary called His Excellency President Kagame. He's a visionary who managed, like a good captain, to put the team together to work around one mission, one vision, and make us really work for one plan. How to bring this country to the next level. How to develop each and every Rwandan to be part of the process with one thing in mind: leave no one out of benefit. Wow. This was for each and every sector: education, employment, etc. The country has still a long way to go. We don't have $810 per capita today. What is half of many of neighboring country, when U.S. have more than 50,000, 5000. However, we have children better vaccinated than in the U.S. We have a compliance to HIV better than U.S. We have a rate of HIV patient on treatment survival better than. I don't want to continue because it's not a competition. It's just to tell you that money is not the issue. The brain, the heart, the policy, the willingness are key for success.
Mm-hmm. It's hard to follow that comment because it is so striking that we're sitting here in Kigali, and before my team came here, I said, you're going to be surprised because it looks like Beverly Hills driving around. It's so beautiful here, and the people are so wonderful. It's hard to remember the genocide we went through. But to your point, even though you have some of the best child mortality results and maternal mortality and other figures in the world, it's only $810 per capita. That's
and
remarkable.
This is, if we look at you, what you have in the U.S., we should, the majority of the world, sit on their chair and just wait the rest of the money mm-hmm. to come. Mm-hmm. We just say, poverty is not a fatality. The future is in your hand. You cannot change the past, even the second where you are, because it's long term. But you can change the next second to come. The future is ours. So with this in mind, money is not the bottleneck. The bottleneck is the scarcity of imagination. The bottleneck is the fact that you believe that what you provide to people is good enough for them. The bottleneck is you to believe that the next generation doesn't have to have 100 times what you have.
So beautifully said, Agnes. That was fantastic. Let's talk about something that's really important to both you and I, and that's women. Mm-hmm. Okay, Rwanda has been so progressive in leading gender equity efforts. The World Economic Forum places Rwanda among the top 10 countries to be a woman. You have more women in parliament than every country in the world. Have you seen priorities shift as women have become more involved in government? And in Rwanda's case, I believe it's in the majority now. So what's the difference that made?
So the difference is, first of all, let's go to the roots of history again. I hope that people that are working in the philosophy of politics will work on that, because it was in the political agenda of the ruling party we have now in Rwanda, gender equity. Now, the first step was to put in the constitution that if 30% of one of the two gender, because only two gender are recognized, but are not elected, elections are canceled. What happened, my dear, when, because all political party want to be there, they push their woman up front. And suddenly, between two elections, we had 48% of women elected. And what it was beautiful, because this country before 1994 was not promoting education. And I can show you evidence of that. And certainly not women education. So the number of women, even from good families with means, when I say good family, is good financial settled families, didn't educate their women like they educate their boys. So we had those women elected, trusted by the community. The country took time to educate them in parliament. They didn't know how to do a law, they learned it. They didn't know how to run a parliament, they learned it. So it is the evidence that the bottleneck, the world see to a situation is just a lack of imagination. Mm-hmm. And women did well. And I remember being in a broadcast in another radio, Where they call me, when they call some people, they call leaders, just to make fun of them, etc. Saying, yes, but women are there, and what are they doing more than men? And I say, before the one majority of men, what did you ask them? Nothing. When they were sleeping during the session in parliament, nothing. So, and I remember the women said, tell them, in here, we are in a radio that is quite progressive, but I'm interrogated by four men. Mm-hmm. You are not even capable to find four good journalists, and I have more than 100 of them in mind. So it's just that too many people in the world just want to do business as usual. And what we have, we are not satisfied with. So how do you want to have different results if you do the same thing? Imagination, and just project you in the future where you have true gender equity. And I don't want a woman for a woman. I want a capable woman that will help to advance the agenda. But to have a capable woman, gender equity in education, gender equity in responsibilities, gender equity in exposure.
This is Peggy Clark, and you're listening to The Bridge. Make sure to listen to Season 1 of The Bridge, which is available on iTunes, which features powerful conversations between wise women of different generations about topics that matter most. In other news, our sister podcast, Aspen Ideas to Go, is digging into journalism, democracy, and fake news. A recent episode features Washington Post editor Marty Baron. Washington Post is known for accountability journalism, or keeping a close eye on people in power. Baron thinks truth is under assault, and his staff have been more blunt, he says, about calling out falsehoods. He explains how his reporters and editors are grappling with fake news criticism. Find the episode Democracy Dies in Darkness in your favorite podcast player. Just search Aspen Ideas to Go. And now, back to The Bridge and my conversation with Dr. Agnes. Do you think there's a particular approach to government priorities that could be called women-centered or women-sensitive? Or, you know, we're asking this in the United States, we're calling this the women's wave, and it's happening in a lot of places in the world where we're seeing more women in leadership. So, does it make a difference with more women in leadership positions?
So I want to say that you are a very special country where you have almost more women educated than men, more women performing than men. We have mostly the richest CEOs with women are more discreet. But in this country, we didn't have that. We didn't have enough women educated. And we didn't have enough women with exposure. What this country decided to do is positive discrimination. Meaning, if a man and a woman are competing and the man is a little bit more in marks for a position, we give the position to a woman. So that we open more opportunities for women than for men. So up to the time we got equality, now it's no longer there. Now you just have to be the best. But because we have space, we are far from that stage where women will not get the position because they don't know exactly how to talk, they are not exposed, they were not as much educated. But I know that I have benefited of that. Mm-hmm. Hmm? And the country have benefited of that. Mm-hmm. But this is just a temporary measure to establish equity. Mm-hmm. When equity is there, same for all. Mm-hmm. That means the day equity, equal, equality, you can go for same for all. The time where equality is a tool of inequity, because I give you the same as man, but you need more to reach what man can reach. When equality is a tool against equity, do discriminative actions in favor of the vulnerable group.
Yeah, absolutely. So let me ask you again about...
And we will do that in our university. Yeah. Meaning, okay, 70% of students in medical education will be girls and women. And there is only 30% of sports for boys, men.
Wow, interesting.
So we are not, because the world so far, fewer doctors are women than men. And even when they are there, the promotion is slower for women because they spend 2 years for each baby they produce. For me, I want every woman pregnant in the health sector, in the research sector, in whatever, to be considered as a mentor of a Nobel Prize and be rewarded to produce that precious kid to the world and not be recognized as somebody who just lost 2 years in his scatter because she produced a baby. A mantra of a future global prize.
Absolutely. And pride. And recognizing that's the future, yeah. So let me ask you, Agnes, do you think there's a global women's movement? And do you feel like you're a part of it?
There is a very strong global movement coming from all corners of the world. And we are part of it because you, Peggy, me in my capacity, we want to change the center of gravity. We want the center of gravity to be at the center of gender equity. And we will make it. Because the world is better when we are based on equity. And when we are based on providing the necessary attention, tool, and capacity for the most vulnerable to be equal to the others. So there is notably a conference called Women Leaders in Global Health, a movement started in Stanford with Michelle Berry, which continue in London 2018, and I'm very proud to say with a lot of humility but a so big smile that the next conference 2019 will be in Rwanda. And this movement drag the youth across the world, drag researchers, drag academicians, drag clinicians, program management, decision makers, to reflect on how to accelerate gender equity in global health, knowing that global health starts where you have your 2 feet.
Mm-hmm. Which is on the doorstep of a woman. That's absolutely where your foot is standing. So, fantastic. And we invite all of our listeners who are interested in finding out more about that event on global women's health to contact us. So, Agnes, let's move to a little bit of another talk, but it's really very connected. You talk a lot about the social determinants of health, and what that means is everything that happens outside of a doctor's office that influences a person's state of health and well-being. And you talk about being some of the most overlooked aspects of women's health. So where should we be putting our attention that we are not?
We should put our attention in each and every one of people we want to provide clinical service, but in a holistic manner, mm-hmm. meaning that person is linked to her family first, mm-hmm. her community second, her nation third. Mm-hmm. And if we don't, we are just another tool that kill her sometimes. Sometimes it's okay. But sometimes it's killing the lady. Meaning, if we don't create the capacity of safe delivery, we increase the risk to die giving birth. And look at what happened with Ebola. In countries where the health sector were not strong, women were afraid to come to deliver with skilled people in health facilities because they were afraid to be infected by Ebola because there were Ebola patients in the health facility. What happened? They start again to deliver at home, and the number of women dying for complicated pregnancy increased due to Ebola, a secondary actor that was that virus who put those women at risk and many die. They had complicated malaria. They could have been helped at hospital. They didn't went there because they were afraid of Ebola. They died in community. So providing care, you need to think about how can we create a demand, provide the care without harming and in a safe manner, and also bring back the person we provide care safely at home. And Ebola is an extreme example. But if there is no trust between the population and the health sector, I will question everything good the people pretend to do for me. And I will don't follow it. And if there is no compliance, the treatment will not work. And it's even dangerous. Take antibiotic if you don't trust. You take the first part of the treatment, not the second one. You create resistance, and you are more sick at the end of the treatment than in the beginning. And you create. You are part of antibiotic resistance, and you are a public health threat. Coming from what? From lack of trust. So trust is. And now the law. If you have some law that doesn't allow people to reach out to get care, the law is a tool of killing. If you have a transport system that doesn't allow, for example, a woman to go alone to get care, need to be accompanied by a man, and there is no man available when she needs it, she will die because she doesn't have the man with her to take the bus. So the social determinants of health are as much important to manage, to make them part of an enabling environment, than the quality of clinical service.
That's beautifully stated, Agnes. That's so, so important. And these are the kinds of things that your university is really going to be illuminating in much, much bigger ways, right?
Absolutely.
So looking at it in this holistic way.
Changing the center of gravity, think holistically about healthcare services, including thinking about all social determinants of health, and also cultural immunity to be able to be a listener and at service, or all those tools that help you to be at service of the people for their health, for their human development, and not selfishly being considered as somebody who have the knowledge, who are on top of you, even with the bad intention, not be the cowboy of global health, just be the humble servant of the people.
That's beautiful. I love that idea of humility and health. So let me ask you, is there a health issue that you are most impatient about right now?
For example, the world has done so much clinical trials with so much positive results that we could apply now and save millions today. And we still go for so many clinical trials. However, we don't go for implementation science trials who help people to implement the discovery of yesterday and today that already will save millions. This fascination for clinical trials is good because it has created vaccine. But I want to give you an example. We have created the fantastic HPV vaccine that's lied in cupboards during years because it was maximum 30% coverage in the best country and zero in the majority of the countries. We got the chance to have it in Rwanda. First attempt, 93%. Since then, more than full 7 years. We never go below 93%. So it's not the issue to have incredible scientific discovery that give a tool to the world, that the private sector turn in a medical product we can buy. This is not health. Health is when the people benefit of that. That's why we have based our university on implementation science, the heart of doing, the heart of achieving.
Beautiful. Beautifully said. So let's switch to a little bit of a personal question. So you opened this university with the president, all these people. It was just a few days ago I saw you, and then you're looking beautiful today in your pink outfit. And what I want to know, and what our listeners will want to know, Agnes, is what personal practices or disciplines do you take in nurturing your own leadership skills that you would advise any emerging female leaders to pick up and take seriously?
Oh my God, I'm still a learner.
It's really true.
I'm still a learner. And I have discovered so much that I'm so humble. Mm. And I'm capable to cry now, tackling this mic, because how beautiful it is. I have learned that the world is full of good people. Some of them has been turned in devil because of some trauma or lack of love. So I have learned to love people. Just to be capable to have more soldiers in the fight of global health. And also, the needs are so huge across the world that we cannot afford to lose even one potential global health fighters. And what I will advise to the people that are listening to us is just try to make sense of what we're saying, sense of what your life is, sense of what you hear, that what happened across the world, so that you can do the biggest good around where you are. Global health starts where you have your 2 feet. But never condemn anyone, because they don't have the same ideas or they have bad ideas for people. Try to understand why, and what I have seen around me, the majority of them is because they are insecure, is because they have been traumatized when they wanted to do good, is because they have lost trust in humanity. So our job is not to push them in that corner and fix those problems as they are, is to help them to find a solution to their problem. And when you give a hand to somebody and you drag somebody from that bad attitude to the light of doing good, don't forget that you win 2 person, the new fighter, and also by killing the bad fighter they were. But sometimes math doesn't work. So by just doing that, you win 5 or 10 people.
Agnes, I'm so honored to have you here with us today, and I cherish our friendship, and the world cherishes your leadership. So thank you so much.
So me, I discovered Aspen a couple of years ago. It's a wonderful place where people are coming together to brainstorm on what's next, to think and review of what we have done, and to connect. And those connections help each and everyone to accelerate their program. And this is so great. Thank you, Peggy, for having me. And thank you to have taken time to listen. And I just want to learn more about each and every listener. And I just for that want to each of you go and express yourself in the best of you.
Thank you all, to you all, for listening to The Bridge tonight, a production of the Aspen Institute. Don't forget to subscribe on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. And I'm Peggy Clark. Thanks for listening.